The Lifeboat Hour with Michael Rupert, Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Popular nightclub at the end of the world. Hi, it's me, Mike Rupert again. February 19, 2012. This is the most important show we've ever done, probably ever will on this tonight. Derek Jensen's with us, and before I get to Derek, who's already on the line, I got to do a little calibration here. Let's do a little tune-up before we get ready for Derek. And I'm normally pretty well reserved on this show. I don't cuss a lot, but I'm warning you in advance for those with tender ears, you're going to hear some tonight. Saudis have reopened a field called Daman, which is the very first field, Gusher Field, that was discovered in Saudi Arabia in 1933. Daman was pumped for 44 consecutive years until it was exhausted, and it was cemented shut in about 1982, like Earth 3, something like that. And we had a story on CollapseNet this week that says that the Saudis have gone back to reopen Daman. Peak oil is so real. Iran is beating the world over the head with peak oil. It's a huge story out today. That Iran has announced it's cutting off all oil shipments to Britain and France. Now, there's a little fine print in there, which is that Britain and France don't import very much Iranian oil at all. But it is a shot across the bow. It is a diplomatic, strong negotiation. Iran has already made it clear by a surprise oil embargo this week that it announced and then retracted the same day that it would shut off oil to Greece, Italy, Spain. And these are countries that cannot do without Iranian oil and import a lot of it, which means the European economy is toast. But we knew that anyway, didn't we? Iran is now sailing the Mediterranean with a free hand. China has backed Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Even as we speak, Iranian warships are in a Syrian port, and Iran is now cruising the Mediterranean. And this is absolute evidence. Iran can now use the Mediterranean like a lake. We've had it on the World News Desk on CollapseNet a couple of days ago that the U.S. Navy is deploying four destroyers to the west coast of Spain to defend the Straits of Gibraltar. Let me make this clear tonight. The United States of America is getting its ass kicked around the world on all fronts. And among the parts, the other parts of the U.S. that's getting kicked tonight is the dollar. The absolute stupidity of the failed oil embargo that the U.S., you know, that died, and the economic sanctions supposedly restricting Iran from selling oil for dollars have backfired. The whole world's going System D, and Iran's still selling oil hand over fist. And on March 20th, they will open an oil bourse. And in case you haven't noticed, guys, there is all-out war on the dollar tonight, which is one of the reasons why gasoline is now more expensive than it has ever been at this time of the year. And we will see $5 gas by this summer, I guarantee it. Now, everything is being timed to happen in March. That's when Greece will hard default. On March 20th, Iran opens the oil bourse, but also in March, the FBI will be doing some massive internet shutdown. This is a test of your emergency screw-you shutdown system, like they did on us in a massive cyber attack this week at CollapseNet. I'll come back to that in a second. In the meantime, Japan is not only mortally wounded, but dying. There's radioactive cesium all over the place. No rebuilding has taken place. Japan is losing electrical generating capacity. There are homeless. There is a major influenza epidemic. The Japanese economy has crashed so bad that the Japanese manufacturers are fleeing the country. The U.S. military has taken its troops out of Japan because of radiation, redeployed to the Philippines. And all around the world, there are blackouts tonight in all major, many, many major cities. I mean, these are long, serious, protracted 3-4 day-at-a-time blackouts throughout, India, Pakistan, Malaysia, pick. There are riots all over the world. People are rising up, and they're extremely angry. And God damn it, Ron Paul won Maine. And the reason why I'm really angry about that is because back in 2000, people like me were screaming it from the wilderness about the theft of election 2000, and the American people never got off their ass when they saw it in 2000, 2002, 2004, 2006. And I've just about had enough of this, and I think a lot of us feel that way tonight. Now, let's go to CollapseNet real quick before we bring on Derek. We are going to go without commercial interruption tonight. We will play Ritual's very important. We're going to play a new white trash song that's kind of appropriate, but we're going without the break. CollapseNet. This week, we really kicked the bad guys in the cojones when I pieced together that a sudden surprise intervention was being planned for Syria. I think we might have helped blow the whistle on that. We certainly called the events because it was the next day that Iran announced the oil embargo against the West. Iran is just beating the world over the head because it understands peak oil. So anyway, we hit them really hard. We hit them really good. We pieced some good stuff together. And the next day we were hit with a DDoS attack, distributed denial of service attack, that two separate sources have confirmed were the equivalent of at least 20,000 PCs driven, taken over by bots attacking us. The attack was so strong it blew out three nodes or three clusters and an entire network. This is warfare. World War III is on. Now, at CollapseNet, we have just been doing it for you guys nonstop, but we are hurting. We are really broke. I have volunteers. We have volunteers at CollapseNet, people who had no other job, and we would give them, in some cases, $2,000 a month as contractor System D. We would, some get five, but that was all they had, and for 2 months they've been doing all this without, because the cyber attacks wiped us out. We're carrying 1,600 members who could no longer afford to pay. We get that. But my volunteers, our volunteers, the people who are doing this work for you need help. And if you want to know how to do that, and if you think you want to help keep us here at least until March, maybe we'll be out of business by then, but these volunteers have been laboring for your benefit for a long time, and they're hurting, and I want to see my people taken care of. So if you have interest in helping us out, CollapseNet Special Fund. CollapseNet Special Fund, 708 North Gravenstein Highway, Gravenstein Highway, Box 266 in Sebastopol, Sebastopol, California, 95472. Now let's get down to fucking business. Derek Jensen and I have never met. Derek Jensen and I have never spoken. Derek Jensen and I have never collaborated. And I think that the first time that I became aware of Derek was when I was starting to get hot on the peak oil circuits in 2002, 2003. And people come, have you heard Derek Jensen? He's saying the same thing. And along the way, I read several of his writings, and my overall reaction was, this guy don't need no help from me. He get it perfectly. Jeez, I mean, it was like, and he has been ruthlessly eloquent in his opinions, and he has written like 6 or 7 books. Well, let me do the Wikipedia thing. Derek Jensen is an American author and environmental activist living in Crescent City, California. That makes him a neighbor to me almost. He's a little north of me. Jensen has published several books questioning and critiquing modern civilization and its values, including A Language Older Than Words, The Culture of Make-Believe, and Endgame. That's a 2-volume deal. And he holds a B.S. in mineral engineering physics from Colorado School of Mines. Good school. He understands the geology. And an M.F.A. in creative writing. He is an amazing writer. The movie NCIV was based on Derek's work. And what happened with this, and I think Spirit had a reason for Derek and I not meeting until just now. I think Spirit had that laid out. But last week I had come across something that Derek wrote called A New Declaration. And I read the whole thing on the show last week, and it was an absolute, it was in perfect tune with me and where I am. So maybe tonight, Derek and I can offer you like a parallax view from two eyes to add some depth to your understanding of what's happening in the world right now. Derek Jensen, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for your ceaseless work over the years.
I'm sorry. I had a problem with my volume. I didn't hear you, but did you ask me a question, or am I going to ask you one?
I said, thank you for having me, and thank you for your ceaseless work over the years. It's been very important.
Thank you very much. I'm having a little problem with my headset tonight, but we're going to make this just fine. Derek, tell us, what should people around the world be thinking about and doing tonight?
Well, I think one of the things that we should be thinking about tonight and every night is the fact that 200 species were driven extinct today, and 200 species will be driven extinct tomorrow, and the day after, and the day after, and that 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone, and that 99% of the prairies and wetlands, and 98% of the old-growth forests. And I think people should be thinking about the fact that you can't consume a planet and live on it, too. And I think people should also be thinking about the fact that there will not be a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, that those in power are sociopaths and you know, one of the questions that I ask people all over the country is I ask them if they believe that we live in a democracy, and people laugh. And I say, do you believe that the government takes better care of corporations or human beings? And they just laugh and laugh and laugh. Because it's a silly question. Everybody knows that the government takes better care of corporations and human beings. And so those are some of the things I think people should be thinking about. And does that mean the fact that there's not going to be a voluntary transformation, does that mean that we should not be acting? Does that mean that we should do nothing? And the answer, of course, is no. It means that we should allow that understanding to inform our strategy, and we should allow that understanding to inform our actions. And I mean, here's one more thing, and then I'll shut up, which is that they say that the ability to recognize patterns is one sign of intelligence. Well, I'm going to lay out a pattern. Let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years, which is when people think about Iraq, when they picture Iraq, it's the first thing they think of, cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touches the ground. That's how Iraq was prior to one of the first written myths of the dominant culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hillsides of Iraq. And then the Near East was heavily forested. And they still have one cedar on the flag of Lebanon, of course. Greece was heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. There were whales in the Mediterranean. And there were whales so thick in the North Atlantic that they were an impediment to shipping. What this culture does is consume land bases. And one more thing about that, which is one of the disadvantages, two of the problems with consuming land bases, apart from the fact that it's immoral, two of the problems with this is one of them is that if you consume your land base in order to, I mean, if you consume your land base, one of the things that does is it commits you to that path, because once you've overshot your carrying capacity, you either have to conquer new places or you'll experience a die-off. And so long as there were new places to conquer, they could continue to expand. But on a finite planet, that's obviously not a plan with a future. And the other problem with this is that if you're going to consume your land base instead of living sustainably, that gives you a competitive advantage over the people you're going to conquer. Just a real quick way to say this is that if you're going to cut down all the forests to make ships of war, you're going to have an advantage over those who did not cut down their forests to make ships of war. But once again, that's not a plan that is going to lead to sustainability at all. Oh, and one more thing I want to say, which I think people need to be thinking about, is if I had to condense all of my work into just a couple sentences, it would probably be that, as I mentioned before, those in power are sociopaths, and the problems we face are not entirely rational, and therefore they're not amenable to rational solution. By which I mean, you and I can talk and talk about peak oil, and we can talk about sustainability. We can talk about all these different things, but that the problem is not that those in power don't understand these issues. If we could just explain peak oil clearly enough, there would be a sudden transformation of policy, because the problems are not simply one of information, but instead they are of, to use a very broad word here, mental illness.
It's
they are
like living in a really dysfunctional family.
Exactly.
You know, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, and how all of us who've labored on the field of peak oil can relate to having been, how simple does it have to get? What, you know, and watching for so long such I would say evil pathology behind it all. But I just did this today. Post Carbon has just released a new video. I forget what their title is. It'll be up on the yellow bar on CollapseNet tomorrow, I think. But I called this Post Carbon video the ultimate zombie litmus test, because I think we're at a point where we really have to seriously disengage in every way possible and say, we don't have time for the people who don't get it.
I think there's a lot of truth to that, in that a couple things about that. One of them is that I remember reading probably 15, 20 years ago in some book or another that the author said, you know, that he had found that it takes people 10 years to change their minds.
Mm-hmm.
And what the example that he used is that when he was younger, he had found himself arguing vociferously anti-choice on abortion, and then with no discernible transition, about 10 years later, he found himself arguing strenuously pro-choice. And this is one reason I don't actually argue with people generically, is because I found that, so what I attempt to do is I attempt to present information, and if somebody's not ready for it, I just move on to somebody else, because that's one of the things, is that there are a lot of people, there is increasing recognition that the system, you've already sworn, so I'll go ahead and swear, there is increasing recognition that the system is entirely fucked. Or, well, it's even worse, because it's not fucked, because it's accomplishing what it's supposed to do, which is to privatize profits and externalize costs. And so there's increasing recognition that that things are desperately wrong and they are not going the right direction. And that recognition is makes it so there are increasing numbers of people who are ready to actually at the least talk about these issues. I mean, seriously, peak oil has been around forever, but do you think that you would have had an audience that is as sizable as it is in the 1950s?
No.
Let's pretend that there was a theoretical understanding of peak oil from the first days of peak oil. This culture was still living in an age of exuberance at that point. And I just read the other day, I didn't read this. My mom told me this. She said that prices went up, cost of living went up 3%, not even adjusting for the collapse of the dollar, but that wages, non-adjusted for inflation wages, actually went down last year. And there are increasing numbers of people who recognize that they're getting shafted, and I think that makes really fertile ground to begin building a resistance.
You know, I've been active in many, many levels, and I've been active in presidential politics. I was Ross Perot's press spokesman in L.A. County in 92, and I'm following Ron Paul. And there's a story that we're going to have on the World News Desk tomorrow where he says America's in danger of slipping into fascism or something like that, which is really not true, because I interviewed Ron Paul in his office in late 2001, right after the Patriot Act was passed, and he was saying that we had become a fascist nation then. We are obviously overtly, this is not closet stuff anymore, folks. We are an overtly fascist dictatorship now.
You know, one of the jokes...
Although the dictator is not one person, as it was in the, with the case of Julius Caesar, it is money. That's the dictator right now.
Well, exactly.
And this whole system is dying. I've got a question that came in before the show, and I think this is a really good one to lay on you. This is from Andrew Sautel. It seems like we're stuck right now in terms of some forms of sane society emerging out of this current mess. There's a great need for mass nonviolent action and organizing that both directly confronts power and organizes alternatives. In terms of confronting industrial society's effect on the planet, there's a great need for a few dozen people just to start pulling all the plugs right now. In your work, you rightly say we need it all, but do you have any thoughts on these two very different but necessary modes of action? That's a meaty question.
I would agree with that completely, and I would... it is possible to shut down the system through nonviolent means, and to think about that, we just have to go back 14 months to the strikes in France, and... One of the differences between the strikes in France and, for example, Occupy was that they were thinking, and I'm not trashing Occupy with this. I'm just saying that one of the things the French did is they recognized that oil is the black blood of the economy, and instead of doing more or less random sit downs. They blockaded oil terminals, and when the French government attempted to then access their strategic reserve, they blockaded those as well. And if you've got the numbers, you can. One of the central things to understand, and Gene Sharp understands this, that, you know, that sort of the guru of nonviolent resistance, is absolutely brilliant work. One of the things to understand is that those in power only understand force. Uh-huh. And that force can be nonviolent if you've got the numbers. Once again, you've got the French who were able to shut down the economy there by the force of their numbers. And on the other hand, if you don't have the numbers, if you only have seven people, you can't exactly blockade every oil terminal in any country. And the best example I can think of for this, and I want to be really clear before I say this, that I am not advocating assassination. I'm simply talking about a lever. I want to be very clear. I'm not even wink-wink not suggesting. I am explicitly not suggesting this as a tactic. But a great example of one person manifesting a lot of leverage, almost, was George Elser, who single-handedly almost stopped World War II. And the way he did it was he was a trade unionist who didn't like what Hitler was doing to the trade unions and didn't like other things he was doing. So, long story short, he attempted to assassinate Hitler and very nearly succeeded in 1939. And everybody who studies resistance to Hitler recognizes that with Hitler dead, there is no World War II. I mean, there's still, you know, German militarism, German anti-Semitism, all those other problems, but there is no World War II. So that's an example. Once again, I'm not suggesting, for any number of reasons, I'm not suggesting that that's an appropriate tactic
right,
here.
That's
an example of one person manifesting great leverage. And so what we need to do is we need to start thinking, what do we want? And then, so that's part of the problem with the whole sort of left or resistance or whatever we want to call it, is that I don't think we've done a really very good job of figuring out what we want precisely.
Right.
How can you figure out a strategy
if you don't
know what you
want? Necessary moment of clarity. But it's clear from my perspective that necessity is the mother of invention, that as things get rapidly, increasingly, exponentially worse, we will see a lot of innovation, and there's kind of a big dramatic question as to whether the innovation or the rise or the willingness to change consciousness, even without knowing where you're going to put your foot, to some extent. Who knows whether we're going to have enough time. We're on the space right now where, in order to keep the rhythm and the mood at this nightclub at the end of the world, we play a song, and it's the perfect song for us tonight on the Lifeboat Hour here at Progressive Radio Network. Our guest tonight, by the way, is Derek Jensen. You can find more about Derek at www.derek.org. He's a great guest tonight. The new White Trash song that we're going to play is the first song that that I ever got a writing credit for. It's when I discovered, holy shit, I really can. I am a song. And it was like a cool moment. But the theme is appropriate. The song is called We Can't Escape From, and it has one of the best lines, I think, that the band New White Trash ever put together. And it says, forget about the doctor, the ache in your tooth. Take another Advil. Put on your working boots. So here is We Can't Escape From.
Another long wall, and we've come up red. Getting dying, sold for lies that we said. Now we can't escape from. Another long wall, and we've come up red. Getting dying, sold for lies that we said. Now we can't escape from.
Vocals were Kristen Weigard, a legend, great bandmate of ours, song by Doug Lewis and all of us at New White Trash. It was mastered, mixed by Andy Kravitz, a two-time Grammy winner, and kind of fits, and we have to make our art fit our experience. During the break, Derek, we got some questions, and let's roll back to these, because there's some good questions coming in. Your fans are showing up. Here's a question for you. I'd like to hear a discussion of how the Dalai Lama, MLK, Gandhi shield has been used as a way to avoid actually doing anything that might change our course. Go ahead, Derek.
Well, I think that I used to do, whenever I would do talk about physically fighting back against those in power, a lot of times the response was pretty predictable depending on the audience. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times sort of mainstream peace and social justice activists, mainstream environmentalists, and so on would put up what I've taken to calling a Gandhi shield, which is they would just say that the joke is that they would repeat the names Martin Luther King, Dalai Lama, Gandhi again and again so fast to keep all evil thoughts at bay. And the response by other groups of people is really very different. A lot of people of color, especially American Indians, a lot of the poor, a lot of survivors of domestic violence, gang kids, prisoners, mm-hmm. would say, well, tell us something we don't know. Let's go, bro.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized pretty quickly that the difference was that for the latter groups, violence is not an abstract question to be puzzled through, a spiritual question to be puzzled through. It's simply a part of life.
Exactly.
And you deal with it. It doesn't mean you participate, it doesn't mean you don't participate, but you deal with it. You don't turn it into something that's not. And so I think that the notion of not fighting back against those in power, not using whatever means are at our disposal, whatever means are necessary, I should say, is a result of privilege. And one of the things I mean by that is, if somebody, I'm at my mom's house, and if somebody burst in right now and were going to attempt to kill either one of us, I would fight like hell.
Mm-hmm.
But and this is what we see among many indigenous peoples, this is what we see among many of the very, very poor, is that their lives are actually threatened, and they fight back. And for us, it remains this sort of spiritual abstract thing out there. If we were to feel the immensity of what is being destroyed right now, we wouldn't be having these discussions. Another way I put all this is that if space aliens came down from outer space and they were systematically vacuuming the oceans, mm-hmm. and changing the climate and putting dioxin in every mother's breast milk, we would fight like hell.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's the government to which we pledged allegiance as children, we've been co-opted into the system, and suddenly we become really not very smart.
But it's overtly killing us now. I mean, as I was listening to all this, and we talked about this a lot on last week's show, too. But, to sum it up in a Mike Rupertism, you can't treat arterial bleeding with feng shui. And that's really, I think, the point we are at now, where we have to break out of every box that we've ever been put into, break through. Because truly, there's no time left to do anything, and there are many of us. Let me ask you that question too. There are many of us who really don't believe there's a very good likelihood for any kind, or for a very small positive outcome from what's on us right now.
Well, I have a friend who says that what he thinks that things are going to get worse before they get worse, and I really agree with that.
Yeah.
I don't. And things are already bad for, every cell in my body wishes that that we as a people communally, taken as a whole, were addressing the significant problems that we face every day, that the world is facing every day. Every cell in my body wishes that there was movement in the right direction. But one of the things that makes very clear to me that there will not be any sort of change is the attitude of those in power to the melting of the Arctic. And the attitude is one that I can only describe as lust for the increased access to whatever mineral or energy reserves are up there.
We had a story that I ran it from the wilderness. This is way back in 2005, I think it was. And it was a story saying that business and the U.S. government were ecstatic over the fact that the polar ice cap was melting because it would open a northwest passage.
Yep.
And, it's like, oh, my God, where do you go? I have something from let me give out the call-in information, because even though I haven't done that yet during the show, we're getting some really good response for Derek Jensen tonight. If you want to ask Derek a question, the number is 1-888-874-4888. 888-874-4888, or you can email me directly at lifeboathour@collapsenet.com.
Before we go to another question, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
And this is probably really basic to you, but it's something I'm not quite understanding yet, which is we recognize that the U.S. economy is in a process of collapse. The European economy is in a process of collapse. You know, all the things that you and I both recognize. And we also recognize that the stock market is detached from both the lives of most Americans and also the economy in general.
Inversely, the Dow Jones is inversely proportional to the happiness of the people.
Well, so, okay, given those, it's still, I'm kind of boggled that it continues to go up as the economy collapses. Do you have a short answer that I will understand for
well,
that?
Yeah, okay. What the stock market is measuring now, of course, everything in the market is cooked and manipulated and massaged. But probably one of the fundamental things driving the stock market is price-to-earnings ratios. In other words, the total market cap is the price, and the earnings are net profit. And in this climate, with the accounting procedures that are being used, and by laying people off and liquidating, they are able to show really heavy net profits as they cut, slash, and burn.
Okay, I understand now. Thank you.
Okay, so that's a part of it. The other part is that, and again, all the numbers are massaged and rigged and all that. So we can read the trends. Is that as Europe has been collapsing, people seeking to flee the euro have decided to put their money into U.S. stocks, which they consider to be foolishly safer.
Okay, gotcha. Thanks.
So anyway, we had a caller who didn't want to go on the air, but wanted the board to tell you this: what is stopping us? Or I guess it's a question: what is stopping us right now? I'm just charging up all our credit cards because who cares about the people who would come after us? Oh, go ahead, Derek. Go ahead. That's fine.
Well, I think culturally that's clearly what's happening.
Yeah.
And was the question what is stopping people personally from doing that?
Yeah, nothing.
I think that's what a lot of people are doing, but I don't think at this point a lot of people are not doing it. Out of any sort of either political move or out of personal selfishness or anything. I think a lot of people are doing it because they lost their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And how else are they going to keep the kids fed?
I guess my response would be if that's what somebody's worried about right now, they are totally missing the big picture here. You know, if you think
well, thank you for saying that because I was actually going to be a bit kinder, but I think we start back with what I said at the beginning, which is 200 species went extinct today. I mean, there are stolid scientists who are saying that the oceans could be devoid of fish within 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
The oceans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're talking about life on the planet
concerned.
Here.
Yeah.
I think what we need to do is we need to. There are parts of China that now have no flowering plants because it's so polluted that all the pollinators have been killed. This is, 500 million years of evolution?
Mm-hmm.
The planet is being dismembered. This is a planet that gave us our lives. It gives us our lives. And if that's not worth fighting for, I don't know what is. And the question I thought it was going to be is what's keeping us from... What I thought it was going to be is what's keeping us from fighting like hell.
Okay.
And I think part of the answer to that is one of the answers I think is privilege because we're being bought off because our lives are not directly confronted right now. There are people who are dying because of this, but for the most part, they're the people who grow our coffee. They're the people who are brown and somewhere else.
I think it's because,
mm-hmm.
And of course I've had a great many years to watch this evolve. I think it's because before people will really fight, each time they think about rising up to fight, they become overwhelmed by something that seems so much bigger than they are. But it's not until you reach the point where I think we fundamentally understand that this is a life and death struggle between good and evil, and you can view it no other way, will the battle be joined. And that's kind of what we hope for in the 100th monkey.
Yeah. I completely agree with you, and I would also add that one of the greatest recruiting tools for the French resistance in World War II was the Allied invasion.
Mm-hmm.
Was actually before that, was the recognition that the Nazis were not superhumans and that they could be defeated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that makes me really happy about, that makes the current time a great time to be living. Because there's a famous line in environmentalism by David Brower, which is all of our victories are temporary and all of our losses are permanent. But the truth is that right now, with the collapse of the economy, it is really possible for our victories to become permanent, because if we can stop some terrible thing from happening, I mean, if people would have taken out dams in the 1950s, the United States government still had the money to rebuild those dams. At this point, they don't have the money.
Correct.
At this point, they don't even have the money to maintain roads. And so at this point, it is very possible for our victories to start becoming permanent.
Well, see, that's one of the reasons why what we do at Collapse Net is so important, because you can see the victories there. And there were major victories throughout the Occupy movement, and those victories are still, you know, well guarded and being cared for. Anonymous has been out kicking some major body blows. And I find that incredibly encouraging. Now, I say that in the full knowledge. Look, they just launched a DDoS attack in me with the equivalent of 20,000 computers. I could be wiped out any day, but this is the war. This is the fight. It's right now. Along those lines, this is great synchronicity tonight. Paul Farr writes in, Mike, can you ask Eric about the Weathermen Underground? I'd like to hear his opinions about the group, and also ask him if he sees this type of movement coming back.
I think that one of the good things about the Weather Underground is that they manifested a rage that many people felt.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the not good things about the Weather Underground, and I think a lot of them would agree with this, is that there needs to be a firewall between above ground and below ground organizations.
Yes.
And I think it was a huge strategic error and also not good for them to attempt to take over Students for a Democratic Society.
Yes.
And so I would like to see as we see an increasing militant response, not response, but a militant resistance, mm-hmm. to the fascism of this state, I think we need to keep that lesson in mind, because they were very harmful to the SDS.
That was exactly what we spent the whole show on last week, and the subject was the so-called Black Bloc, the people who show up around Occupy encampments. And I stand with Chris Hedges firmly, and I stand with my own experience, because I was around during the 60s as well, seeing that contamination that took place across movements was the compartments had to be kept watertight, because we had, a Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, we had Cesar United Farm Workers. I mean, there were so many directions from which the will of the people against the government and the corporations in Vietnam and racism had risen, that it was a multi-front attack. But it's absolutely critical to keep those activities walled off. I totally agree.
You know, I sometimes get called, not fairly, I don't think at all, I sometimes get unfairly called the violence guy, because I do talk about putting violence on the table and discussing violent resistance. But that's not accurate at all, because what I feel like is I'm really the everything guy, because I believe we need to have full spectrum resistance, from the most I mean, it's like, for crying out loud, only 2% of the IRA ever picked up weapons.
Right.
That's the IRA. That's not the Irish people. That's the IRA itself. And 98% were doing various forms of support work, which could be including making food for people, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the point here is, I'll just shut up now, because I'm just validating the same thing you did. There needs to be an absolute firewall.
Yeah, no. Otherwise, it risks everything. And let me just add this little dimension here, because I also have a life spent in the world of military, martial, cop, warrior shit. And I don't think it's a matter of saying that violence is on the table, Derek. Violence naturally has never been off the table. It's not. It's in the self-defense response mechanism is in every living thing. And it's there for a reason, and it's spirit-given, and it can't be taken away.
Thank you for that, and I would agree completely.
Okay.
And in addition, and you and I both know this, you can't take violence off the table anyway because those in power are already using it.
Oh, ding, that was great. I'm going to steal that, but I'll give you credit for it.
Oh, you can have it. Lingua franca.
We have another question for you. Mike and Derek, seems to me that systemic collapse, to some degree, coming to the USA, whether it be enforced upon us and initiated by us or a Jean provocateur upon us, okay. I work full-time and part-time jobs. I have people I care about. I've been preparing spiritually and so far only spiritually. My morbid curiosity now seems to be driving my psyche to survive physically past this coming changeover. What basic steps should people like me be taking? I live outside of a major metro area about 40 crow miles, D.C. Well, I know that area. I was born there. Feel free to paraphrase and or edit. Derek, go ahead.
Yeah, I got two responses. One is that so far as what we can do to survive personally, any sort of collapse, I think, well, a couple of things. It's pretty funny, and I have to tell you this story because you've been involved with peak oil stuff for so long. You know, peak oilers have been trying for years to get me to, like, get a year's worth of food in the pantry or something,
mm-hmm.
And I was just like, whatever. And then, you know who convinced me to get a year's worth of supply of food? Is my sister, who's a Mormon.
Uh-huh.
And so it's funny because it wasn't the peak oilers who actually convinced me to get canned food. It was my sister for other reasons. But anyway, the preparations are pretty obvious, you know, in terms of self-defense, in terms of getting to know your neighbors, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there are plenty of resources to figure out how to survive personally. And then after that, just hope. But I want to – there's a more important point here, which is that I can't remember his name right now. He was one of the central members of the resistance against Hitler on the Eastern Front. Very, very important.
On the Eastern Front.
Eastern Front. Yeah, it's. Oh, I can't remember his name
Russian?
Right second. But anyway,
Russian,
the point
Ukrainian?
Is that
okay.
when the Allies invaded in 1944,
right.
the members of the various plots to stop Hitler started asking the question, why do we even bother? The war is essentially over, and so let's just protect ourselves.
On Stauffenberg you're talking about.
No, I'm not talking about Stauffenberg. Anyway, the point is that they approached this one guy and said, so what should we do? Should we just call it all off? And because the war's over now. It's all going to be fine. And he said, no, the Nazis are killing, I think, 12,000, 16,000, whatever. They're killing 16,000 innocent people every day. And every day sooner that we can stop this war is 16,000 innocent people who will survive. And this culture is dismembering the planet. Even if what you care about is your own survival, as opposed to the salmon, as opposed to anyone else, the sooner we can make this happen, the more that's left of the world. And, I mean, if somebody would have brought down civilization 100 years ago, whatever that means, people in the Northwest could still eat salmon. At this point, there aren't enough salmon to support us. There are going to be people 30 years from now, 40 years from now, who are starving to death, and they're going to be wondering why we didn't act when the world was going down.
Well, and of course, my historical answer to that, because I've probably been the best record keeper of the saga, is that the answer is that a great many people did start doing something, but they did it for themselves, where they lived, for their family. They didn't undertake or climb the cross to carry the mantle of trying to have to save all civilization before they took care of their own silly, dumb butts and figured out what they needed to do.
And I don't think that those are in contradistinction. I think that one can personally prepare at the same time that one also resists.
That's my life. That's what I do. That's exactly right. I mean, I'm on this beautiful 2.5 acres here. We've got permaculture rocking. We're going to be into aquaponics soon, and we are so blessed here. But we're doing all of that work on the same level as I do, you know, the work that you and me and so many other people have done. You made a point earlier that hit me very strongly historically. As I was writing my second book, Confronting Collapse, from a historical standpoint, a lot of things fell into place because it wasn't until King Hubbert was proved correct in 70, and then in 73 he testified before Congress, and Congress paid very, very close attention, or 74, maybe, 75. But Jimmy Carter was well aware of peak oil, and, you know, that's what he was addressing at the time, because Hubbert had made a profound influence, and all of the governments in the world, and this is in Rubicon and everything else I've done, they have known that this was coming for a long time. And yet, the dinosaurs or the scorpions, you know, just had to, and I think maybe that's our liberation, because these putzes running everything right now can't be anything other than what they are, and those who win in a rigged game get stupid. Sorry, that was my little diatribe.
No, I'm nodding my head, and I think that that is one of the ways, I think that that is one piece of information that we also need to keep in mind as we figure out how we can best resist, and what we should do is to recognize that those in power will continue to act like those in power. And one of the things this means is that any attempts to beg the capitalist in chief to not act in the interests of capital may be useful propaganda in terms of raising awareness of issues, but they're not ultimately going to succeed because the capitalist in chief cannot do but support capital. And then in addition, I mean, I don't know how this would play out individually, but I'm stunned at the, I'm continually stunned, even though I've been writing this stuff for God knows how long.
Yeah.
I'm continually stunned at how consistently, one of the jokes I used to tell through the Bush era was that I don't think I could have done a better job of destroying the U.S. economy than George Bush did.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm consistently stunned by the stupidity is one word,
the
activeness is another word, of those in power. The predictability, the absolute predictability of their responses is pretty extraordinary.
But there's something deeper and more venal, and this gets to the heart of this this tsunami, the top of which none of us can see from our vantage point. It's not just that they're predictable, because what's clear now, Derek, and this is what I've said since it became clear that Greece would hard default, abundantly clear last August, and now Zero Hedge has come to take the same position, and they produce Goldman Sachs documents. Dmitry Orlov has reached the same conclusion. We've got more stuff on that on the World News Desk on that today. But this is all being choreographed to happen at once. So there is a dark awareness that is synchronizing. The death of Japan, that's synchronizing peak oil, that's synchronizing Europe to make this all happen at once, which bespeaks now something other. There is an intelligence behind this, because we just can't mistake the fact that somebody up there pulling levers understands exactly what's happening, and they're trying to choreograph this.
So how is that in their best interest for consolidating power?
That's one of the spiritual questions where you get to a certain point, because the only conclusion that I could come to is these people know they're using up the planet, destroying it, and they're going to leave themselves no place to live. And the only answer that I can come to on that is a spiritual answer, that the darkness seeks and begs for its own death, and it will be satisfied with nothing less.
Yeah, I completely agree, and that's another thing that's been central to a lot of my work that I have never seen in a lot of environmentalist work. You see this a lot in indigenous writing,
mm-hmm.
is that the dominant culture is driven by a death urge. And I've written I mean, you said I've written 6 books. Actually, I've written about 20 books.
Oh, my God. Sorry.
No, it's fine. It's perfectly fine. My point is actually, I mean, it's like, you know, I can't even read them as fast as I write them. And the point in saying that is that I've written like 20 books on this, and I still, you know, people ask me, why do they act the way they do? And 20 books later, I have no idea, you know? It's so incomprehensibly evil to me. The best explanation I've ever seen by anybody was by this guy, Jack Forbes, who wrote this book called Columbus and Other Cannibals. And in there, he talks about a spiritual illness with a physical vector and also a spiritual vector, so that if I get the flu and I cough, I can cause you to get flu symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
But if I have what he calls the cannibal sickness, or the wetiko, like, I don't know how to pronounce it, W-E-T-I-K-O illness, that if I have that and it's contagious and I give it to you, then you also have to consume the souls of others. You become a capitalist.
Man.
You have to consume the souls of others to survive.
It's like...
That makes more sense than anything I've ever written. Really.
We are running out of time here, Derek. I wish we had like a ton more time. Our guest tonight's been Derek Jensen. Very glad to be out on this field with you, to be witnessing this. Glad for your clarity. We are all just spectators now, and the spiritual mystic part of me just says, pass the fucking popcorn. You know, and let's see how we can go from there. Derek, thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to sign off here in just a second. You can find Derek at derekjensen.org. Our guest next week, although he has no clue that it's going to happen yet, is Dmitry Orlov. But I can pretty much guarantee you he'll be back with us next week on the Lifeboat Hour. Stay tuned. This was a great show. Understand what you're facing, and the more clearly you can see it, the better you'll be able to deal with it. Derek, thank you for being with us. We'll see everybody on the show next week.
Thank you. Let's do this again.
Okay, man. Oh, absolutely.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Good night, everybody.